Today's Teisho will be on case 44 in the Mumon Kan, the Umen Kwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 44 is entitled Basho's Staff. Basho Osho said to his disciples, If you have a staff, I will give you a staff. If you have no staff, I will take it from you. Mumon's comment: it helps me wade across a river when the bridge is down. It accompanies me to the village on a moonless night. If you call it a staff, you will enter hell like an arrow. Mumon's verse: the depths and shallows of the world are all in its grasp. It supports the heavens and sustains the earth. Everywhere it enhances the Dharma. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity this morning to do Kinhin outside. As you know, sometimes we barely notice the world around us. We're so caught up in our concerns, some of them important and some of them trivial, that we can't be present in the moment. Sometimes we're thinking about things that really are essential. We have something to accomplish that's important and that people depend on, and we have to be very focused. And in that state, you know, you go from point A to point B and you don't notice what's along the way, usually. And sometimes we're caught in our mental loops, playing and replaying and unable to get free. And in that case, also, the world as it is disappears. It's quite wonderful to be able to come here and sit down on a Saturday morning and focus on the breath and enter deep mushin, or at least begin to enter mushin, begin to quiet the mind, begin to be still and present. Here in this dark room, all sitting together, it's very wonderful, really wonderful. And then to go outside into the light, into the heat, and walk around in that big circle. Every step is alive with sensation, information, textures, scents. It's really extraordinary how rich the moment is when your mind is in that calm, focused, somewhat empty state. It's enormously different from, say, the normal distracted experience of the world. And so it's just marvelous that we could do this morning, that we came here to purify body, mind, and heart by sitting in emptiness. And then to go out and embrace the world in that way is really magical, really wonderful, and also quite special, it seems to me. You know, many people hear about this practice and it has no effect, makes no effect on them, has no effect on them. They hear about Zen, they've seen pictures of people meditating, and it doesn't speak to them. And they may be very wise people or they may be very foolish people, but it just doesn't resonate. But for those of us who have a hunger for a certain kind of engagement with the world, this is really precious, you know. To be able to practice Zen, is, for me, was really an extraordinary thing. I could say the most extraordinary thing in my life was learning how to do Zen meditation. And I didn't appreciate for many years how precious it was to practice with other people who were like-minded. It's not a cult. It's just being able to be in the moment with other people who appreciate this aspect of the moment. That's really precious. And so sitting together in the dark, watching our breath, mindfully attentive to the moment, and then going out into this sensory environment that's very rich, almost overwhelming, it's like a miracle, right? So beautiful. Every sound is pure. Every fragrance is pure. When it's not blocked or screened by that wave of thoughts, everything comes alive in the most extraordinary way. But it's not always possible to be like that, partly because of the way we live in modern society. A few days ago, I ran into somebody who was whose son was suffering from depression. And the person said to me, do you think meditation would help my son? And I said, yes, I do. I also think maybe finding a good therapist would be a wonderful idea. And the person said, do you have the name of a good therapist? And I do know some therapists. So I said, please email me and I'll send you those names. You know, when the person said that, I was really struck by how many people I know who suffer from depression. I was just reading about David Foster Wallace, a writer who committed suicide a few years ago, who was chronically depressed and is quite admired writer. And I know many people in my department who have struggled with depression, and I know many people who struggle with depression. People in my own family are on antidepressants almost all the time, a number of people. And I just run into people all the time. And I've realized that in some ways, you know, depression is like the illness of our time, you know. I think people blame themselves for being depressed, but I'm not convinced that it's an individual, it's produced by individual decisions or actions. I think it has a very strong social component and cultural component. I think the fact that so many people are depressed says that there's something about our way of life which is producing this. I really believe this. I think I speak from experience because I myself have, in my life, struggled with depression, you know. I didn't really understand this until I was reading some books on depression, and I realized that I was depressed in the earlier part of my life, and probably quite depressed, maybe not clinically depressed, but, you know, chronically depressed. And I started doing meditation. I didn't really know I was depressed, and I didn't really realize I was getting better until a number of years later, and I was just better and happy, you know, which was unfamiliar to me. I think that depression has been around for a while, but I do think it's so widespread because there's something in our culture, in our way of life, that we have to be careful about, you know. And I think Zen can help. I had the opportunity recently to go to Saudi Arabia. I'm an English professor, and Rutgers University is trying to create some cooperative arrangements with some universities in Saudi Arabia. I was asked to come and evaluate a number of English programs, and it was really a whirlwind tour. We flew out on last Thursday. My colleague Veena Kumar and I flew out, and it was like a crushing trip. It's about 7 hours to London, and then it's another 6 hours to Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, And there was a 4-hour layover the way out actually we went to Frankfurt on the way out, a 4-hour layover in Frankfurt, and then it took 3 hours to get through customs, so that was truly a beating. And then the next day I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and fly again to a regional university. And that was my week. I would get back at night. But it was fascinating. On the last day of the trip, our hosts took us to the old center of Riyadh. And it looks very much like Albuquerque. It looks very much like Santa Fe, New Mexico, only and not as nice. And let me say, Riyadh is not what you would expect. It's a city of 4 million people. It has big department stores like Nordstrom's, giant malls. It has malls. It has commercial strips as far as the eye can see and sprawling suburbs with homes built in a kind of a southwestern style. I could have been in Phoenix. It looks like Phoenix, you know. The only difference is that in Phoenix, all the men don't wear white robes and all the women don't have to hide their heads, you know. So all the men wear white robes and all the women wear black robes with little slits for their eyes to see out of. Under those robes, they're all wearing polo shirts and khaki pants and beautiful clothing. And they're going shopping and they're going to restaurants. It's a thoroughly modern city in a lot of ways, except for these prohibitions on the two sexes intermingling. And of course, it's rather strict. At five times a day, when the call to prayer is issued, everybody just stops everything they're doing and they go to pray. I was talking to a professor who was a Saudi himself, and of course he was a Muslim, and he said, "This makes me so mad." He said, right in the middle of the lecture, you know, he's a scientist, he said, "My students are doing some experiment, and the call to pray comes," and he said, "They all stop and leave the room." And he said, they need to understand, it's okay, you know, God will forgive you if you finish the experiment, and then you go, you know. He was so teed off about this. He said, "This has to change, you know." So, you know, the people who brought me there were very interested in enhancing education, especially, by the way, education for women. The Saudis have just spent, believe it or not, $20 billion on a new university for women, which is extraordinary. You know, it's an extraordinary place. It has a monorail. It has a gigantic library and state-of-the-art technology. It's got solar collectors. 20% of its power will be from solar collectors. So they really want to produce millions of educated women, and they're spending a lot of money. Anyway, on the last day of the tour, they took us to the old part of the town. And the old part of the town was a fort made out of mud, a giant adobe fort. And this was where the Saudi family, the royal family, lived until maybe the 1960s. And we went through the tour of the fort, and by the way, it's 115 degrees, okay, that day. And it can get up to like 130. And the fort itself had, you know, they had hidden secret air conditioners in the old adobe building. But it was still very hot. When you got out in the courtyard, the heat was quite dramatic. And they had a photo gallery in one of the rooms, and I noticed that the cars in front of that Riyadh looked, was mostly a mud city until well after World War II. And you could see these photos of American cars from about 1930s, 1940s, next to the Royal Palace. And then the streets were just these adobe mud buildings as far as you could see, just like Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I realized that really modernization didn't start in Saudi Arabia until after World War II, like the 60s. So this society has gone from simple life, primarily agricultural, like, and then they've gone from there to traffic jams and consumer culture and department stores in less than a century. So it was very interesting to see. And, you know, it was a bustling metropolis. But I was happy to be there. I think that there's a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who have good intentions and who want to modernize their society and liberalize their society. And when I was in these classrooms meeting with students, I was only allowed to meet with the men. My colleague Vina had to meet with the women. But when I met with these boys, whose English was okay, you know, pretty good, it was like talking to a bunch of American students. They were so similar. You know, some of them had baseball under their Saudi headdress. They wear baseball caps turned backwards, just like American students. And they all listen to rap music, you know, so they were nice kids, you know. I really liked them. So it was quite an interesting experience. But, you know, I realized that they've been through, like, a tremendous culture shock, you know, tremendous. And they're trying to hold on to their past history while modernizing and going forward. And that's so difficult. And I wondered, you know, if they would be successful. I really hope that they will be successful. It's a real gamble. You know, they're going to make English the language of instruction in their universities, which is amazing, right? They're going to try to make all courses at the university conducted in English. That's why I was there. And they want help with this. And why are they doing this? Well, English is the international language, and they want to be part of the world community. So I think that their leadership is moving them very gently into the 21st century, towards the 22nd century. And I thought it was a fascinating social experiment, and I hope it works. As everybody said to me, inshallah. Right? If Allah wills it, it will happen. Right? And I thought, yes, I hope it happens. I hope you have a smooth ride into modernity. But I wonder, you know, they have to be very careful, because I think in our own culture, you know, all these forces have really pulled our society almost to the breaking point. You know, I really do believe that. I think it's one of the reasons that depression has become so chronic in our society. You know, we are, we're a society of immigrants, right? We all come here and we leave a lot behind when we come here. And then there's like constant change in a very competitive, high-pressure environment. And I sometimes think we aren't given enough tools to cope with everything that we have to deal with, you know. I think it's difficult sometimes. I was impressed by what they were doing, but I do think the odds are very high that, you know, they're going to have all kinds of social problems. Like, I understand already they have problems with alcoholism. Even though you're not supposed to drink, you know, behind closed doors, people, especially people in the elite, the educated elite, can get access to alcohol. And who knows, maybe they have problems with depression too. I think that you know, in the modern world, people are told to be very creative and to be very active and energetic, but they're not necessarily very well supported. And I think people often feel like they're told that you can do anything you want. People are said, you can do anything you want. Your life can be any way you want. See? So you're told that all the time. You know, all you have to do is get off your butt and try, and you can be anything you want. See? But then the reality is that actually, most of us don't wind up leading the lives we imagined we would lead or hoped we would lead. And often I think we blame ourselves very fiercely, very aggressively. You know, and I think this is one of the sources of depression in our culture, that we're so much is expected of us, not necessarily is a lot given to us. And then we're held responsible, most of all in our own minds, for our failures to live up to the ideal image. And so you see, even teenagers have already begun to measure themselves against these standards that are quite unrealistic, and then to condemn themselves very harshly. And I don't know, I'm not a psychotherapist, but I think this has a lot to do with the epidemic of depression in our culture. And I think particularly we're exposed to a lot of, we're so exposed, we're so vulnerable because we don't have a strong sense of connectedness. I think we feel very isolated. The modern world makes people isolated, you know. So, you know, this koan is really about discontent, certain kind of discontent. If you have a staff, I will give you one, see? And if you have no staff, I will take it away. See, that is life in the modern world, I think, you know. It's like, we have a lot, you know, we have a lot. You know, this 60 years ago, people in Saudi Arabia were living in mud houses. Now they come home and they have a condo, and it's nice, it's a California-style condo. They drive up in a Japanese car. They almost all drive Japanese cars. There's bumper-to-bumper traffic everywhere in town. You come home, everything is air-conditioned. The idea of having no air conditioning would be laughable. Everybody has air conditioning. The cars are air-conditioned. Everything is air-conditioned. So you come home, you've got TV, you've got the internet. You know, you have a meal. They eat very well, I would say. You know, it's quite a meat-eating culture. I was taken out to many meals that I couldn't eat. And that's a difficult negotiation, right? Because food is so important. I must confess, I did eat a little tiny meat. You know, because it was so important. They said, "Try this," and it's like, if I say no, they're going to think I don't like them. So I this is delicious. You know? How to negotiate that? You know? I mean, even the Buddha ate meat, by the way. It's quite possible that his last meal was spoiled meat. They said that the Buddha some very poor people gave the Buddha some meat. And he knew it was probably no good, but he ate it anyway out of kindness. And then he died of food poisoning, actually. That's how the Buddha died. So I'm not the Buddha, and it wasn't poison. It was very well cooked. So I did eat a little meat, I have to confess. But I thought it was compassionate to do that. And my hosts were very pleased. And I said, "Oh, that is incredible. That camel was delicious." It was camel meat. And it was delicious, by the way. They were being very generous to me, very kind. And they're trying to enter the modern world where all of these options are going to be available to them. But on the other hand, you know, I think we here in the modern world find ourselves very isolated, and sometimes we're not able to live up to the ideals of our society. You know, society says you should be, are you in IT? Why aren't you Bill Gates? If you just tried hard enough, you could be Bill Gates. Are you an actor? Why aren't you Brad Pitt? You know, if you had just tried hard enough, you could be Brad Pitt. Are you a writer? You know, you could be David Foster Wallace. Oops, He killed himself. Why did David Foster Wallace kill himself, right? Because he wasn't somebody even better, I think. I think it's very hard to be a writer because there's always a better writer, you know. So I think this is like the other side of the freedom we have in our society, where we have these goals or dreams, and then when we don't live up to them or fulfill them, we feel it must be our fault, when so much in life is not our fault, right? Or there isn't actually fault, right? I mean, the economy can't have an infinite number of Bill Gateses. That's just not possible. There probably shouldn't be any, in my opinion. Speaking as a socialist, I think there shouldn't be any Bill Gateses, you know. But there can't be too many, right? But we all feel we can all look at Bill Gates or Brad Pitt or David Foster Wallace and say, I could have been that person if only. I could have been this person if only, and it's my fault. And I think we direct a lot of aggression and anger towards ourselves, and this produces depression, understandably, you know, which is the mind's way of protecting you, actually, from danger. The mind just sort of shuts down. It closes down, and it becomes, it's like the lights go off in your mind, and you become dark. And then your mind is trying to protect you. It's like the power is now off, right? And I think it's also a problem because we're so isolated, we're so individualistic, you know, that we don't have resources. We feel disconnected and alone. I think that's true. You know, a friend of mine from the Middle East, when I was in graduate school, was a guy named Mohammed Swaya. And he became my friend, and he and his wife Peggy, who was an American, became my friend. And he would come over to my house all the time. You know, so I would get home from school, and I would be at home, and suddenly there'd be a knock at the door, and who is it? It's Mohammed. And then, he'd go, and then the next day, you know, Barb and I would get up and think, what are we going to do today? It's Saturday. Knock, knock, knock. Mohammed! You know, next day, Mohammed! Hello, come in. Dinner, lunch, breakfast with Mohammed. After a while, this began to feel terribly claustrophobic. But when I, you know, Mohammed was so unhappy in America because he said in his village of El Kef, he said, everybody socializes all the time. He said that people hang with each other all the time. And he said, sometimes you just go over to a friend's house and they all sleep on the roof. They have flat roofed houses, you know. In the summer it's very hot, so everybody sleeps on the roof. They bring the bedding up there. It's a big adventure, right? And sometimes you just stay on this person's house and then you stay at this person's house, and there's a constant human contact. It's so different, right, from North Americans who are all isolated, living in their little apartments, you know, and so on. When I was in Saudi Arabia, I couldn't stop thinking about the Japanese situation. Because, you know, the Japanese are people who have rather successfully modernized, you know. And they have done it by preserving a very strong sense of connectedness. I mean, they have depression too, you know, they have their unhappiness too, But when we saw the tsunami and its aftermath, I was very impressed by how the Japanese people coped. And I read this article in the newspaper that was fascinating. And it said they interviewed Japanese people and they talked about all the ways in which during this crisis Japanese people responded by helping each other. You know, there was no crime. They were helping each other. They did many, many things just as individuals or cooperating as groups, small groups, to help each other. And I saw on TV one of the towns that was really badly flooded was doing this ritual where they had people in masks who represent forces of nature, and the Buddhist priest was there. They were doing this big ritual in town. And it said to me, these are very, this is a very resilient, these people are very resilient. And the article was quite revealing. It said, you know, Japanese people have very high trust in one another. They kept interviewing people and said, you know, they realized that Japanese people don't particularly like their government. They don't necessarily trust their government, but they have tremendous trust in each other. They count on each other to support one another. So there's this very strong sense of social connectedness. And I think it goes beyond that. It's, you know, I think that maybe to some degree Zen and Buddhism are really deeply in their culture, has really soaked into their culture. You know, when you study tea ceremony, when you're served a bowl of tea, you're never supposed to drink it. Isn't that interesting? When you're served tea, you never say, "Oh, thank you." You take the bowl and you put it to the, next to the, you put it to your left to the person next to you. And you offer it to that person first, and only after they've declined it do you drink the tea. And the lesson is others before self, others before self. And I think this is hugely part of their culture. You know, I have this book on Japanese preschool kids. It's preschools and three cultures. I'm interested in education, so I read books like this. And they look at an American preschool, a Taiwanese preschool, and a Japanese preschool. And they said the Japanese kids had the highest awareness of others. So when all the kids are about to go outside to play, it was a Japanese Buddhist preschool. Most Japanese kids spend time in preschool at a local Buddhist temple, and there's always some kindly monk who barely watches over them. And they all have, actually the book said that many, many Japanese people had their fondest memories of childhood took place playing in the precincts of some temple under the benign supervision of some old monk. And they said that when the kids would go out into the cold, they would all look to make sure everybody was buttoned up. So they're looking to make sure everybody else is warm and ready. Not themselves, but others, see. They're very other-directed. And at the other extreme were, as you might guess, who? The Americans, right? And they don't care about the other kids at all, right? They're all about me. This is just a fact, you know. And they're trying to maybe be noticed or, you know, make a statement. They hope their everybody notices their coat and envies their possessions, you know. And it's all about me. And the Taiwanese were in the middle, sort of. So I thought that was so revealing. And I kept thinking about how in this tragedy, the Japanese trust each other very deeply. And what they don't want to do is let others down. You know, so they have this very powerful drive to be, to live up to other people's trust in them. You know, and I think this is a lesson our culture could really learn, really needs to learn. You know, it's not our fault that we don't live this way, and the culture doesn't send messages like, think about others. You know. Be aware of the needs of others. That's not a message our culture sends. You know, when you're walking down the street, a bus doesn't go by, and you look, and there's a poster and says, "Has everybody eaten today? Is everybody safe and warm?" No. The poster says, "Wouldn't you like this product? It will make you special." Right? That's what it's all about. And others might not have it, and you'll be even more special. So anyway, I think depression might have something to do with this, and I hope the Saudi people are able to get over this hump. You know, they all dress the same. Every Saudi male has a white robe and a red checkered headdress. And I hope the women don't have to wear veils, but they all look the same too. And what they're trying to do, I think, is You know, in the ancient times, I'm sure Saudis didn't all dress that way. You know, I'm sure they wore whatever they had, which wasn't much, right? So now they're all dressed the same way because they're saying, we're all in this together, see? And I don't think that's going to work, but it's a try. But we are all in this together, right? As human beings. And I'm, you know, I felt like I was in it with the Saudis. I really want to help them. I hope I can help them. I hope I don't let them down, right? That's their trust in me was very moving. So, you know, I think humans live on trust. Not just trust in each other, but also trust in the world, right? We have to trust the world. And that's very hard because it lets us down sometimes if we fall into a certain state of mind, right? When we have expectations about how things are supposed to be, we are bound to be disappointed. Doesn't mean we don't try, but we're bound to be disappointed because life never follows our expectations. You know, those wonderful words that we recite every morning when we do sesshin, or when we sit here on Saturday, are the, I think, some of the just most wonderful words ever written. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth is set infinitely apart. See? That's the challenge. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, we relinquish any... we relinquish control. Right? We say, okay, whatever happens is going to happen. And I'm just going to observe it. I'm like a neutral observer. That's the best mind for Zen practice, right? And then whatever happens, strangely, you know, can be very wonderful, very beautiful. You know, you might sit down on the cushion and your mind is like, you're in turmoil and you're burning up with whatever. You expected this and this happened. You wanted this and this happened. And it's so agonizing. It's like running in tar, right? Do you ever have a dream where you're trying to fly and you can't fly? You know, people are pursuing you and you flap. I sometimes flap my arms and I can fly in my dreams. You know, so if somebody's pursuing me, I start flapping my arms and I can fly. And sometimes I'm very happy to fly. I have flying dreams. But sometimes I can't fly. Maybe this says those in the psychoanalytic community can reach their own conclusions about my state of my mind. But to be able to, you know, fly is quite wonderful, and we can all fly, but only if we have no expectations, right? Expectations are really poisonous sometimes. You can't learn much, you know, from expectations. You can learn from things that don't meet your expectations, right? And usually there's a growth process involved in that. So, you know, if you have a staff, I will give you one. See, so you think, well, damn it, I don't need a staff, right? I have a car. I have a house. You know, that's not the issue here. I want what I don't have, because that's the nature of desire. That's the nature of the self, right? I was reading that... we might be hardwired to think this way, you know, that there's a lot of... Some scientists think that we are hardwired to notice the bad things. You know. Maybe so. But when we do Zazen, you know, and you're in this mind which is not a discriminating mind, and you get off the cushion and you walk outside, it's absolutely perfection, right? The moment is perfect. The moment is always perfect. It's when we try to have more than it can give us, when we expect more than it can give us, that we begin to fall into abject unhappiness. And we can live there all our lives. But, fortunately, it's possible to live differently. Shuzan Osho held up Basho Osho said to his disciples, "If you have a staff, I will give you a staff, just what you don't need. If you have no staff, what you need, I will take it from you. You know, I'll even take away what you already have. And of course, this koan plunges people, frankly, into a kind of hell for a while, right? Because you suddenly realize all the things you haven't done and haven't been and might never be. All the missed opportunities and all the events that shouldn't have happened to you that happened to you. Right? And so this is a really challenging koan. Mumon's comment, it helps me say, there's something though, there's something in life. It's we felt, you know, probably you felt it today, you know, when we went outside. There's like a kind of energy unfolding in the moment. And trusting that energy is like heaven. Mumon says, it helps me wade across a river when the bridge is down. It accompanies me to the village on a moonless night. That there's something I can trust. There's something I can trust. He said, if you call it a staff, you will enter hell like an arrow. Mumon's verse, the depths and shallows of the world are all in its grasp. What is it? It supports the heavens and sustains the earth. Everywhere it enhances the Dharma. Today, I think we had a little taste of that. Some of us are going to Sesshin, and we will soak ourselves in that beautiful life energy for 5 days. And that will really be nice. So thank you very much for coming this morning. Please come back.